Welcome to What Happened at ASH, the American Society of Hematology meetings in December 2025, immune thrombocytopenia. Are we entering a new age of treatment of this entity, specifically the use of BTK inhibitors and BAFF-R antagonists, B-cell activating factor receptor antagonists? This is a medical oncologist, Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Hani Alsamkari from the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. On the next two issues of this series, you'll hear cases presented by community-based medical oncologists and Dr. Alsamkari's take on these cases. On this program, cases will be presented by Drs. Tina Botnager from Wheeling, West Virginia, Neil Morgenstein from Summit, New Jersey, Jennifer Iannucci from Savannah, Georgia, and Priya Rudolph from Athens, Georgia. We begin with a case from Dr. Botnager.
This is a really healthy 70-year-old woman, very active, who was originally seen for thrombocytopenia with a platelet count of 12,000, and that was just an incidental discovery by her PCP. The rest of her CBC looked normal. I tried to search for alternative causes of her thrombocytopenia, but everything came back unremarkable. I trialed her on a course of prednisone at a dose of 1 mg/kg with some improvement in her blood counts. Because I wasn't completely satisfied with her platelet counts, we gave her IVIG and she had a much better improvement in her platelet counts, and we tried to taper the prednisone. But when she ultimately discontinued, her platelet counts dropped to 33,000 and I resumed prednisone and IVIG. So my questions are, what would be the expert's approach to a patient at this point? And also, since there are so many options when it comes to TPO agonists, how do you decide between the various treatment options and what kinds of factors do you take into account? And also, how many other lines of treatment do you usually try before starting that conversation about starting a TPO agonist? I would be curious to know what other new drugs are on the horizon for relapsed refractory ITP.
This is, I would say, a reasonably typical type of case of an older adult presenting with ITP. Make sure that there's nothing else going on. If it's isolated thrombocytopenia, as it was in this case, no need to do a bone marrow biopsy. If they have other cytopenias, you may be more concerned about clonal myeloid neoplasm as the cause. But in any case, this patient got prednisone, some improvement, IVIG, some improvement. Platelet count dropped to 32,000. I would say at that point, I would have probably watched the patient so long as they weren't bleeding, they weren't on antithrombotic therapy, antiplatelet therapy, or anticoagulation, right? A lot of 70-year-olds on aspirin or dual antiplatelet therapy or what have you. And if they were, that's a different situation. But if somebody is above 30,000 and they're doing okay, I'd watch them. You know, if their platelet count tends to stay above 30,000 most of the time and they're having no bleeding, they probably don't need chronic therapy. If they are on antithrombotic therapy, if they're bleeding, if their platelet counts are not staying consistently above 30,000, then I would reach for something else. And in this case, I think a thrombopoietin receptor agonist would be very reasonable, as would rilzabrutinib or fostamatinib in all fairness, right? Because those are options that one could use at this stage. The doctor asked, how many other lines of treatment do I usually try before starting that conversation about a TPO-RA? One, you know, I will treat the patient with steroids in the first line. And then after that, really wanting to avoid additional exposure to steroids, will try to get them on a second line therapy that, spares them that steroids.
So for a case like this, theoretically, would you give eltrombopag and ianalumab?
I would if I could. I think that would be a great example. You know, that would be somebody who's failed their first line corticosteroids IVIG, and if they were interested in trying to get a nice duration off treatment or potentially right disease modification, this would be a great opportunity to combine ianalumab with eltrombopag.
You know, it's interesting. All these videos we just did in the last couple of months, and I love her last question, like, what's new? Because at that point, we didn't know what was new, what was coming up at ASH, but I know that oncologists are going to be really very interested to learn more about this. Hopefully we can be helpful in that regard. So I'm curious what you think about this next case, a patient from Dr. Morgenstein.
He was young. He was in his early 30s when I first met him. Probably, potentially the only time I was scared taking care of a patient. He came to the emergency room with his platelet count being one. Typically, even when I see patients with platelet counts of one, they're not bleeding. They usually have some ecchymoses. They usually have some mucosal bleeding. He was in the hospital, and during this evaluation, he started to develop GI bleeding and also had a small CNS bleed. He's somebody we threw everything at. We gave him dexamethasone, escalating doses of romiplostin, rituximab. He even received Cytoxan and vincristine, received high-dose solumedrol. And finally, we were able to get his platelet count up high enough that we were able to convince our surgeon to go in and take his spleen out. But at the time of splenectomy, his platelets were still certainly less than 10. Whether it was the splenectomy that did all this or whether it was all these drugs just working, his platelet count eventually normalized and he became completely normal. And I've seen him over the course of years. And the challenge with him is he'll go for a year or 2 years and everything will be fine with a platelet count of 300,000 and then present to the hospital with a platelet count of 1,000 or 2,000. So the question is, when should we perform splenectomies? It's something we used to do when I started my training very often. I don't know if that's still in the algorithm and where we should put it in the algorithm. How is the best way to treat somebody with chronic relapsing ITP but doesn't have low platelets? So is there any role to place him on a medicine like eltrombopag? I'd be curious how often the investigators see patients with not just ecchymoses or mucosal bleed or nosebleeds, but really true gastrointestinal CNS bleeding and ITP.
So this is obviously a harrowing case, right, of this patient with a platelet count of one, with GI bleeding, with brain bleeding. You want to do everything you can, and I totally agree with, giving him dexamethasone to try to increase the count as quickly as possible. Presumably, IVIG would be used as well, right, in a circumstance like this, because that will give us our fastest response, typically within 24 to 48 hours. This guy's ITP was not easy, and it was in his early 30s, which is, a little atypical, but nevertheless, escalating doses of romiplostim, gave rituximab, also gave cyclophosphamide and vincristine. Vincristine is it's not a bad rescue medication, right? We don't reach for it very often because we don't want to give people neuropathy and, long-term complications, but it does work in about 70% of patients, and it raises the platelet count relatively quickly. So it's something that can get you out of a bind. And his platelet count was high enough to convince the surgeon to go to surgery, but still less than 10, right? I think in this case, it's and it would be instructive to see how long it was, between the time that the patient got all these therapies and the time that they ultimately had splenectomy. But it certainly sounds reasonable. This is a situation where we would call it an emergency splenectomy. And that is a perfectly reasonable situation to, do a splenectomy even when the patient has newly diagnosed ITP. We try to avoid splenectomies in the first year of disease because we know that there is it's a modest remission rate in that 20 to 30% range, but there is a real remission rate in that first year. And if we don't have to take someone's spleen out, we would ideally like to not do something that's irreversible. But this is a circumstance where the guy had brain bleed and GI bleeding and all of this other stuff going on, didn't respond to other therapies, and did respond to the splenectomy. So definitely a successful case of an emergency splenectomy. Now, unfortunately, he does still have crashes. His ITP is not quote-unquote cured. But chronic relapsing ITP, or intermittent ITP as sometimes we call it, is a very difficult problem because you don't want to put somebody who has a platelet count most of the time at 300,000 on a chronic thrombopoietin receptor agonist, for example, because then they're going to have thrombocytosis most of the time. It's a difficult problem. I would say for someone like this, now that we have drugs like rilzabrutinib available, and once we have ianalumab, I might be more apt to reach for a drug like that. They're not going to get a thrombocytosis from that, but that is something that would hopefully prevent or be more likely to prevent these very problematic drops, particularly in someone who's already had a brain bleed from a bad drop. I never want him, I want to do everything I can to prevent him from dropping again. And chronic administration of rilzabrutinib, or once it's available, hopefully administration of a drug like ianalumab, I think would be a great option.
Incidentally, I was looking at his history, and it turns out the patient also had hematuria, presumably from a renal calyx.
Goodness, yeah.
Anything we know about why some people have all these, you know, problems with bleeds and other people don't with the same platelet count?
You know, when you take a look at these patients really closely, you'll see that some patients have enormous platelets. Some patients have more normal-sized platelets or not-so-enormous platelets. The automated counters, when the patients have enormous platelets, will sometimes miss platelets. They'll think they're red cells because they're so big. And so you get an undercount. So there is definitely an aspect of analytical, you know, variability or analytical kind of being misled sometimes by the automated counters. And one reason why, you know, I know obviously it's not the easiest thing to do in community hemoc practice, but to try to look at those smears whenever you can to see if they've got huge platelets, right? And if they do have huge platelets that are being missed by the counters, they're a lot less likely to be bleeding. Because what matters, Neil, is conservation of platelet mass. What matters is overall platelet mass, right? So there is a biological, you know, principle, which is conservation of platelet mass. So large flightless birds, they have platelet counts of 10, but their platelets are enormous. And mice have platelet counts of 1 million, but their platelets are tiny. And, you know, different human, you know, populations, the reason why the normal range of the platelet count is between 150 and 450, that's a pretty big range. We don't see that for something like hemoglobin, right? Some groups of people have platelets that are on the lower end of that spectrum, but they're bigger. And some groups have platelets that are on the higher end, but they're smaller. So if you have a patient with a platelet count of 5 and their platelets are enormous, their functional platelet count might be 15 or 20, which is why that person's not bleeding. The other person with a platelet count of 5, their platelets actually are not enormous. They're normal sized, and that person is much more likely to bleed.
So tell me what you think about this patient, Dr. Iannucci.
57-year-old female. I had seen her on multiple occasions, and just for simply iron deficiency. And then all of a sudden in May of 2024, she presented with a platelet count of 6,000. No other CBC abnormalities. Workup was consistent with acute ITP at that time. She responded well to pulse dexamethasone and 2 doses of IVIG with platelet recovery. No other confounding etiologies were found for her acute ITP, including HIV, hepatitis, serologies, nor autoimmune diseases. We have continued to battle her iron deficiency because she has uterine fibroids. She did well until she had a quick relapse just a few months later with a platelet nadir of 2, and this time was treated with rituximab and dexamethasone, completed 4 weekly doses with, again, a good clinical response, and did well until just this year when she once again presented with a acute ITP. So she was readmitted. Because she's steroid responsive, we did treat her again with dexamethasone. This time she did not really respond, so we retreated her with rituximab. She is hanging right now around 50, 60,000. So she's stable. But I think that the question would be, do you observe her? Given that she's now chronic relapsing, would you consider her for an EPO erythropoietin agonist at this point? Would anybody consider splenectomy? So just ideas on the most appropriate treatment for relapsed chronic ITP.
You know, this is a challenging sort of patient, somebody that's failed multiple prior courses with both corticosteroids and rituximab. This is a good patient to consider a chronic treatment with a thrombopoietin receptor agonist. That would be what I would choose next, try to maintain a good platelet count. I would avoid L-trombopag, because this is somebody who has iron deficiency and has had issues with iron deficiency that are ongoing. And the reason why I would avoid eltrombopag is because eltrombopag is a very potent iron chelator. And it actually causes iron deficiency in many people who have ITP who are receiving it who are not iron deficient at baseline. So it would be very counterproductive in this case. So I would reach for avatrombopag or imiplostim, which are thrombopoietin receptor agonists that do not chelate iron, do not have that issue, and would be likely to give this person a more consistent response. If they don't respond to either avatrombopag or imiplostim, then I would try the other. If they don't respond to the other, then I would consider rilzabrutinib or fostamatinib.
What about her question about splenectomy?
You know, I really don't reach for splenectomy very often in 2025. And one of the reasons for that is that in addition, right, to having good therapies that are medical therapies that control the disease well, people with ITP, despite having a bleeding disorder, they have increased risk for thromboembolism, both arterial and venous thromboembolism. That's just because of their disease, right? Their platelets may be hyperactive. It's not fully understood. But I don't want to increase that further. And splenectomy increases that risk indefinitely for the rest of someone's life and also increases the risk rate of infection. And so I think it's a reasonable thing to consider and to talk about, but I would rather defer that until, you know, really I've exhausted many, if not most or all of my standard therapy options. And in addition to that, right, the numbers that people quote about curative splenectomy and ITP are from really 20, 30 years ago, back when people were getting splenectomies after they failed corticosteroids and IVIG. And so people who have failed rituximab and 1-TPRA, just two other lines of therapy, their likelihood of success with splenectomy is about 40 to 45%. It's less than a coin flip. I think that's a little bit of a harder sell. I would not want a splenectomy myself if I was in that sort of circumstance.
So one more question about this case, looking at the sequence, which is this story, you know, I think is not rare. It looks like this patient first got dexamethasone and IVIG, then got rituximab and dexamethasone, then with another relapse, got dexamethasone again with IVIG. Kind of thinking in general, would you go through these three lines of therapy or would you have gone earlier to TPO?
I think I would have gone earlier to a TPO. You know, this is, as you said, it's very common. And we really hope, you obviously hope after you give that first course of dexamethasone that you get a durable response that's only going to see that in about 20% of patients. After that, you try the rituximab and you give steroid along with it because the rituximab doesn't work right away. And you have to get the patient's platelet count out of, you know, single digits. You know, at that point, after the failure of the rituximab, I would definitely, I think, have reached for a thrombopoietin receptor agonist just because, you know, after relapsing from rituximab once, if you try it again, chances are if you get a response, it's going to be even shorter lived than the last one.
So Dr. Rudolph also has a great case. I'm curious what you think about it.
She's a 32-year-old school teacher with stage 2B nodular sclerosis Hodgkin's lymphoma when she was 21 years old. I treated her with ABVD, and unfortunately, she had primary refractory disease where she progressed with relapsed Hodgkin's lymphoma within a year of initial treatment. And so she underwent autologous stem cell transplant, fortunately achieved complete remission, was doing great, and subsequently was lost to follow-up. And I saw her back in 2020. At that time, she came to me because she was having significant bruising, gum bleeds, and also heavy menstrual periods, and was noted to have a platelet count of 4,000. Her platelet counts after her autologous stem cell transplant was completely normal. So I did a bone marrow biopsy when she came in with this low platelet count, and it was completely normal. I also imaged her again just to make sure it wasn't recurrent lymphoma causing ITP, and sure enough, she did not have any lymphadenopathy. All the other workup for other causes of thrombocytopenia was negative. I started her on high-dose prednisone. She had no response whatsoever to high-dose prednisone. I gave her IVIG. She did not respond to that. I switched her to rituximab. She did not respond to that. And while I was trying all these different treatments, she was continuing to have very heavy periods to the point of becoming severely anemic and requiring red cell transfusions. So at that point, I was struggling between should I just go ahead and send her for splenectomy or put her on a long-term treatment with either a TPO-RA agent or in the form of romiplostim or one of the oral TPO receptor agonists. I randomly chose romiplostim as the next choice while talking to her about consideration of possible splenectomy if the romiplostim did not work. And surprisingly enough, just after barely two doses of romiplostim, her platelet count shot up to 300,000 to the point where I held further doses because I was afraid I might drive it further higher. This patient is very young. She hopefully will be planning childbirth at some point. I would like to know if the experts in her particular case, if they would rather choose splenectomy to avoid issues with drug interactions, pregnancies, long-term treatment of a younger patient, taking all that into consideration, would splenectomy be a better choice? How does one decide when to use a TPO receptor agonist versus fostamatinib? And then splenectomy anymore is recommended more or less as a last resort treatment, particularly if someone has been refractory to treatments after a full year of trial of multiple different agents.
Any other questions?
I have always struggled between which is a better steroid, whether it's the four-dose dexamethasone or prednisone with taper. If we do choose to give prednisone, I would love to know how experts do the tapering of the prednisone.
Anything else?
There was some concern for bone marrow fibrosis with TPO receptor agonists. I would love to know where that data stands and if there's still any concern for long-term toxicity with these medications, particularly concerns for either myelofibrosis or myeloproliferative neoplasms.
So, you know, a number of really salient questions along with this case. First of all, I have a patient that's very, very, very similar, a male patient in his 30s at ABVD for Hodgkin's, and then a number of years later relapsed with ITP. So it's sort of interesting, was that prior therapy responsible for some, you know, immune dysregulation or a precipitator, who knows? But this patient thankfully has achieved good response on a thrombopoietin receptor agonist. Her ITP is not the easiest to treat. If she would like to have a child, I think that it would be obviously a higher risk situation and, you know, get maternal fetal medicine consult on board. But thrombopoietin receptor agonists are not technically used as standard of care during pregnancy, although there is a lot of data now, a reasonable amount of data, to suggest that they're safe. There was a surveillance program of vermiplostim, which is what this patient is receiving, that looked at, I think it was 80 women and well over 100 pregnancies. I can't remember the exact numbers, but it was a lot. And these were people that sometimes they became pregnant while they were taking vermiplostim and didn't realize it, or someone made the decision that the only way that they can safely get through the pregnancy is to continue the vermiplostim through the pregnancy. And there really doesn't appear to be any negative impact on mom or baby. When a mom is receiving vermiplostim and she's breastfeeding, that can actually cause a transient thrombocytosis and even circulating blasts in the child. That was shown in a case report. So, you know, ideally not while breastfeeding, but it's all reversible. But during pregnancy, it's something that, you know, is not a decision to take lightly. And most of the time, if the patient responds to something like azathioprine, which we know is safe in pregnancy and can work in these patients. I would rather reach for that. Okay. In certain circumstances, the patient's platelet count is okay for most of pregnancy, but then needs to be brought up above 75,000 for epidural anesthesia at the end of pregnancy. That's a situation where I'm much more, you know, I would much more routinely be okay with using a thrombopoietin receptor agonist like remiplistim during the third trimester after, you know, all critical development is completed to raise the platelet count in that way. I don't think we have to go in and take people's spleens out in order to get them ready for pregnancy. And in this case, I would estimate this patient has a less than 50% chance of succeeding with splenectomy, given her treatment history and her prior failures leading up to this point.
I'm curious, have you seen significant bleeding complications from ITP in a pregnant patient?
I have. These patients are at increased risk of postpartum hemorrhage. They're at basically any bleeding manifestation of pregnancy, they're at higher risk for. And they're at higher risk when they're not pregnant, right, of having heavy menstrual bleeding and all of that. So I would consider them high risk. And you know, I have a low threshold for using tranexamic acid, right, around the time of delivery to reduce pregnancy-related bleeding, to reduce lochia, bleeding after the woman has delivered. The tranexamic acid is very safe to use in patients with ITP, and so it's something that is low-hanging fruit that can reduce this bleeding. But yes, they are definitely at higher risk.
So it seems like every oncologist I talk to asks the question about what's the better steroid, dexamethasone or prednisone, and how you taper it. Any comments? And also her question about, quote, bone marrow fibrosis with TPO agents.
Yeah. So there was some thought that dexamethasone pulses may be lympholytic when given to patients with ITP early on and therefore be potentially disease modifying. That question has been answered. Unfortunately, the answer is no. So there is no difference in overall response rate when using dexamethasone in pulses, and that's usually given as four doses of 40 milligrams, you know, so 40 milligram daily times 4 days every 2 weeks for three cycles. There's no difference between doing that and doing a 6 week prednisone taper in terms of overall response rate. You can get maybe a quicker response with the dexamethasone overall, approximately an average of 1 day faster. So, you know, 4 days instead of 5 days kind of thing, which can be helpful. But keep in mind, right, the risk of the patient crashing in between cycles is something to be concerned about. That does happen, number one. And number two, if they're an older adult, they're at higher risk for psychosis and other acute steroid complications when you give them a big dose of dex than when you give them a lower dose of prednisone over the course of a taper. So I use mostly prednisone. If I really want the patient to respond faster, I'll use dexamethasone. But there's not really a whole lot of difference. And the question about bone marrow fibrosis with thrombopoietin receptor agonists, this has really been put to rest. If you give somebody a thrombopoietin receptor agonist and you check their bone marrow during a bone marrow biopsy every 6 months, you'll see an increase in reticulin fibrosis after the first year, 2 years, and then it will level off. And if you stop the TPORA, that reticulin fibrosis will go away very quickly. It will return to normal. And reticulin fibrosis is not permanent. So the permanent kind of fibrosis that we get worried about is collagen fibrosis. That is not increased. That does not happen from TPORAs. So this is not something to worry about. And patients getting TPORAs do not need to get regular bone marrow biopsies or to follow regular peripheral blood smears looking for teardrops or anything like that.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Elsam Khairy, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for What Happened at ASH 2025, ITP Edition.